supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, this situation with Baltimore running back Ray Rice and the video has really triggered discussion all over the world. I mean, it's not just in this country. The story is horrific. Unfortunately, similar stories get repeated too many times. Like, you know, like I said in the opening before the news, nearly one in four women and over one in 10 men will experience domestic abuse at some point in their lives. For same-sex couples, the numbers are higher. It's a tough subject to talk about, even especially when we get beyond finger-pointing and blaming and shallow explanations about why this happens. It's uncomfortable when we look at the humanity of victims and perpetrators. And most of us have seen abuse happen in our lives somehow to someone we love, someone we know, if not to ourselves. So today, we're going to be having an open, honest conversation about a very uncomfortable subject. I'm happy to welcome Tony Lapp to the show today. Thanks for coming, Tony. He's co-director of Menergy, a program that treats men who have committed abuse. He's active in and beyond Philadelphia. He works with both English and Spanish-speaking communities. We're also welcoming back, after 27 years, Marcy Witherspoon. Oh, my God, to say that number. Marcy Witherspoon. She's the former director of Children and Youth Institute at the Institute of Safe Families. She's part of the Philadelphia ACE Task Force, which is Adverse Childhood Experience. And she's currently an independent social worker and trainer. Marcy, welcome back after 27 years. You look the same.
Thank you. So do you.
Right. And if you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. Tony, let's start with you in reaction to the Ray Rice controversy. Your own op-ed piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer that President Obama's reaction to this was hitting women is not something a real man does. So this raises questions about if it's not a real man, who is hitting women, and what does it mean to be a real man?
Right. Yeah, you know, when I wrote that article or that op-ed, I was thinking that I was responding to what I was expecting to be a really fleeting sort of news story, and so I kind of dashed it off earlier in the week, and it's been fascinating to watch the way this story has been developing, and they ended up running it a number of days later. I was concerned in writing it that I have a couple of things. It makes me sad, but it probably does need to be said that real men don't hit women, and the reason it probably needs to be said is because real men do hit women. You know, in our program, we work with many people, many men, week by week and year by year, who do and have hit their wives and girlfriends and partners. And getting the message out that that's not the right thing to do and that's not a good definition of manhood is probably important. But part of what I was interested also in writing that op-ed in saying was that I hope that's not where the conversation stops.
Right.
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 And that if we're going to be talking about manhood, we need stronger messages than that. We need messages that go beyond that.
You know, men who are doing these things, you know, you say they're not real men. I mean, the last thing they need is to be further humiliated and put down and be called names. Right. I mean, that's not helpful.
Right. You know, doing this work with people that have hurt their partners has made me think an awful lot about labels, right? I think that if you're working with somebody who's struggling to own the thing that's happening to them and has been getting messages a lot of their life that they make too big of a thing about problems and that they shouldn't be assertive. I'm thinking about some of the traditional messages that we've often given to women, that there may be a real power in coming up with strong words that describe the problem. And so when we talk historically about domestic violence, we've used language like battering and violence, and this is really important. Interestingly, sort of in the day-to-day work at Menergy, the labels sometimes feel like they get in the way. So we use labels. We have to at the systems level. You know, we're part of the Domestic Abuse and Battering Intervention Network of the state. When we try to distinguish what we do from just straight sort of anger management, then we are having to use language. But just last week, you know, I was having a conversation with a guy who was really hung up on the idea that because he had been referred from a jurisdiction that had told him he had to go to batterer's intervention. And this was really hard for him to wrap his head around the idea of labeling himself a batterer. And it was fascinating to watch him sort of as I kind of talked him through what we were talking about here, and that we were going to continue to use serious language. We were going to talk about abuse. We were going to talk about the things that he had been doing that were really wrong and really damaging and really hurtful. But that the issue wasn't the identity. The issue was the behavior. So we could talk about him as somebody who had acted abusively. Yes. Someone who had been very hurtful, yes. But does that mean that he is a batterer, that he is an abuser as a fixed thing that cannot be changed?
Yeah, that's who you are.
Right, as an identity thing. Sometimes that doesn't feel helpful. The question is, how do you make some of those sort of nuanced shifts without taking away from the seriousness? Because the truth is, we do sometimes work with people who have done very scary and dangerous things.
What strikes me in the discussion is, you know, and I alluded to this in my introduction, it was we're so quick to judge. We the larger community who bears witness. We the perpetrator is a pariah or you know, questions about the character of the victim for staying in the marriage. So I want to try to ferret this out with you. Let's first talk about some of the reasons why she would stay. I mean, Ray Rice's fiance, you know, married him and dropped charges and defended him.
Yeah, well, this is where this issue gets so complicated and tricky, and why there, I think, has been so much coverage, a saturated media of this issue, because people stay for lots of reasons, one, and lots of legitimate reasons. One, because leaving is the most dangerous time for many people.
How so?
Well, preparing to leave, leaving, and the first few months after leaving are generally when, if a fatality is going to occur, that's when it occurs. Because somebody who feels like they're going to lose control, if somebody threatens to leave or leaves, they might do just about anything to regain that control. So leaving is dangerous. That's one reason. Another reason is that leaving is a process. Leaving has to be done safely, and it has to be done so that it can be successful.
Wow. And you know what you're talking about? Leaving has to be thoughtful and planful. And how do you do that when you're scared for your life every morning? I mean, you can't when you got, you know, that limbic system on fire in your brain.
Exactly, exactly. You're functioning in the survival part of your brain.
Yeah,
you can't be rational and thoughtful and be thinking in your cortex. And so it really, so leaving is often a crisis situation, and it's an emergency. That's why leaving sometimes requires somebody to come back, because they may not have thought through everything and they may not have done it in a way that's safe. And besides, many people don't want to leave. Many people decide there are enough reasons to stay.
Why?
Well, first of all, they might love the person that's been abusive to them. Mm-hmm. This was somebody that they met and fell in love with, one would imagine. They may have children together. They have a life together. They have feelings for one another. They may own property together. They have a history. And so they may decide that they want to work things out. They fell in love with somebody who's not a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, probably, the abusive partner is nice and is like the person that they fell in love with. It's only occasionally or intermittently when somebody actually has to deal with either a physical altercation or some controlling behavior.
When I counsel men and women who are recently divorced, women almost universally, and not men, feel that they were a failure. They were not able to fix the marriage. I hear this rarely from men and almost universally for women. And I would imagine that's the case with women who have been beaten in a marriage also. They feel responsible.
Particularly if they are told by the abuser that if you had only done X, Y, or Z, then I wouldn't have to do this. Or if you had only come home when I told you to come home or fixed what I wanted to eat for dinner. Or so if the abuser is projecting blame upon the victim may feel like it isn't. She may internalize those kinds of feelings.
I want to turn to you apropos of what Marcy just said. And I want to talk about why abusers abuse. And, of course, I know there's no simple answer. But in my research, I found an article by Donald Dutton. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Yes.
He authored numerous studies on batterers' personalities. And he described the difference between impulsive abusers, and these are the one that are likely responding to situational stressors who don't create a pattern of control with their partners. And then the instrumental abusers who use violence as a method to control, and they're more likely to have a personality disorder or their own history of violence. Mm-hmm. And if you agree with this, this sets up two very different dynamics in the marriage, yes?
Right. Yeah, you know, Dutton's been around for a while and has been working at trying to do this. There is debate within the field about the utility of some of these the categories.
Labels again.
And also just how sort of if you move somebody into that, then that's sort of the expectation about what motivates someone. And it doesn't always feel like in real life it plays out that simply. So, you know, when somebody comes to our program, Dimenergy, we're looking at a couple of basic things. We're trying to get a sense of how honest they're willing to be, how much they're willing to disclose. We have a couple of ways that we try to work with people around that. We're also trying to assess their ability and willingness to feel any feelings of empathy or compassion towards the people that they've been hurting. And we're also trying to get a look at what level of urgency they feel around putting energy into changing, and because we know that this change process is going to be a hard process. We've learned over the years, we're learning. I think of this as a young field still. I think we're still mm-hmm. very much in the process of learning, but we've been learning things that have been important to us. We've been learning an awful lot and to look a lot more closely at issues of emotional and physical trauma. Absolutely. We're learning as the broader mental health world is learning about brain chemistry we're paying attention to, right? We look at substance abuse issues. We are certainly looking at issues of sort of personality structure. When in the process of engaging somebody, we're also trying to do some looking at their backgrounds and what are the antecedents, right?
The message there and that I try to give my patients is what you've done is not who you are. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at your brain. Let's take a look at your body chemistry. Let's take a look at your genetics. And then let's take a look at your environment. So mm-hmm. There's a lot of things. And it's not necessarily about your character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about things that are internal, that aren't visible. And this takes away a lot of shame from them, you know, and then they're more comfortable.
Right. And the idea of thinking almost about appropriate embarrassment or guilt or shame. Uh-huh. I mean, what else is a conscience if it is not that part of us inside that kind of twists when we recognize that we've done something wrong? But that's something that many of us run away from. And it causes problems if we run away from it, because then we're losing the potential utility of it. We're losing the things that the ways in which that internal voice could guide our behavior. So part of what we're trying to do, it's a really delicate balance. The hope is not to humiliate someone, it's not to overwhelm them, but it is trying to push them to look pretty squarely at what they've done and how that makes them feel. And then if they are willing to go there, then to offer the possibility of hope and respect.
Let me give out the numbers again. We're talking with Marcy Witherspoon and Tony Lapp about domestic violence. It is awkward and uncomfortable. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to say this. If you've got a history, or if you're currently in a situation of domestic violence, please call. You will be treated with great respect and care, and we will do everything we can here to help you. If you are a perpetrator, if you have harmed someone you love, please call, and we will have the same respect for you and compassion as we do with any other caller. Mm-hmm. And we will get you the help that you need. Same with friends, family, and neighbors. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, it's 888-477-9499. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back in 60 seconds with so many more issues that we really do have to touch on. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in Project Impact, a research study at Drexel University. This weight loss program is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. Project Impact is funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-553-7110. Drexel University supports WHYY.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day, because it offers something different. WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage, offers a gateway to the arts, and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about domestic violence with Marcy Witherspoon, who's former director of children and youth at the Institute for Safe Families. She's part of the Philadelphia Adverse Childhood Experience Task Force. Tony Lapp is a therapist, licensed clinical social worker, and he's a co-director of Menergy. It's a program working with abusive men. And like I said before the break, please call us if this is an issue that is touching your life or has touched your life. Our number is 888-477-9499. And if you like, you can just call in and leave a message. You don't even have to be on the air. Just leave a message. I'll get the message and bring it up to our guests. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I want to talk about what you said, Tony, during our break. Hmm. you said you wanted to get resources up for men and women, mm-hmm. and you mentioned specifically what you had said earlier, Marcy, about planning. So right. tell us about resources for men. How do they get to you? And resources for women. We'll get them all up on our webpage.
I do think, you know, this conversation should not happen without really recognizing the fundamental role of the domestic violence advocacy organizations. They're the ones who have essentially taught us how to do this work, and domestic violence work in this country is a really nice example of a very grassroots beginning that has grown into something. And it started with people just sort of helping somebody that they knew and realizing that there weren't resources and having to figure out what laws needed to be pressured for, and we needed to create shelters and have other things. You know, with leaving, there is something that the four agencies here in the city are very skilled at. They call it safety planning, and it's very detailed, and they're a great resource. It's Women Against Abuse, Women in Transition, the Lutheran Settlement House Bilingual Domestic Violence Project, and Congreso's Latina Domestic Violence Program. They're four fabulous agencies. We partner with them all the time. We think of our work as being done in a kind of an accountable relationship. The conversation goes back right to the beginnings of our program. We had their feedback in the creation of our program. And they, you know, when the partners of our program, if I'm going to have them, if I wish anything for them, it is this kind of support.
All right, back up. You went too fast.
Sorry.
Name those organizations.
Okay. Women Against Abuse. They run shelter. They do legal services. Fabulous organization.
Okay.
Women in Transition, they do safety planning and empowerment counseling. They are they run a program that is sort of dual, helping people that are getting hurt who also are struggling with substance abuse issues. Lutheran Settlement House's bilingual domestic violence program is the oldest Spanish language program in the state, and they do empowerment counseling and safety planning. And Congreso works a lot with children around the children of people, and they are also, of course, bilingual services. Fabulous organizations.
You left one out, with all due respect.
Menergy.
Thank you, Marcy.
I'm talking about the advocacy organizations. I think of us as an intervention organization, which is a little different thing. Certainly consider ourselves part of the effort in the community, but I wanted, they're not here today, and I want their voice to be here. Their voice should always be part of these conversations. They run a hotline together. It's 24 hours. It's a wonderful resource in the community.
Marcy.
So the hotline number is 1-866-723-3014. The hotline, should I repeat that? 1-866-723-3014.
All's going to be on our webpage.
All four organizations staff the hotline, mm-hmm. and all of the organizations, all of the advocacy organizations, and I ditto everything that Tony is saying about the advocacy work that all four organizations in the city and Women Organized Against Rape, who also do sexual assault work. Mm-hmm. So it's domestic violence and sexual assault. But I also wanted to add that all of those organizations and then many others are participating in a citywide initiative in Philadelphia with some of the major systems, including Child Protection, Office of Supportive Housing, Behavioral Health, et cetera, physical health, to address the development of a coordinated community response to this issue of domestic violence.
I want our lens now to get a little more narrow about John or Jane Doe, who are in this dangerous situation. And we should say that, you know, we're assuming it's just men who are the abusers, and that's not the case. I was surprised to hear these numbers about how many men are abused. You know,
I don't know if you want me to. The statistics vary, but typically what we hear is about 85% of victims or survivors are female and about 15% are male. And the numbers, we don't know. That's probably a distortion of the percentages.
Sure.
Because of the way we socialize boys into men in our society. And it's
right.
A difficult enough situation to disclose victimization being female when there are advocacy organizations that do focus specifically on females, or at least several of them. So it's probably there are a number of men who are victims, as there are women who are abusive in their relationships, either heterosexual or same-sex relationships.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Julie. Julie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just want to ask the question about getting men help for who are abusers. I work as an advocate, and what our experience is most of the time they take absolutely no responsibility for their part in the abuse, and it is a power and control thing, and it's always the victim's fault. So I'm just wondering if you have any percentages about what percentage of men who are in these situations are you actually able to reach out to and help?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I'm going to turn that over to you, Tony, but I've got about a couple of questions to follow up on that.
Okay, so I'll be
real Tony, thanks for your call, Julie.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things we see is that very few people walk through our door just having suddenly woken up one morning, looked in the mirror and said, oh, I'm doing bad things, I should stop today. Most people that come to our program come pushed in some way or another. Now, I have a lot of compassion for that. I think that that's actually true in most of our lives. It's certainly true in my life if I think about the major changes. Almost all of them have happened at places in my life where I've realized I have something significant to lose if I don't make the change.
Right.
So we get some people through the courts, about 70%. That's low compared to many countries around many programs around the country. But we also get people sent by therapists and HR departments and faith communities. The hotline certainly refers to us. But it is very common for someone to show up, for example, if there's no court involvement, because their partner has just left them or is threatening to do so in a way. It would be lovely to think that we can just appeal to people, but, you know, let's face it, we get into patterns, and very few of us are going to jog out of those patterns if we don't have to.
So I would imagine you, either one of you, have no way of knowing about the men or women that don't get into treatment and the percentage of them.
We know some things. We know that we're reaching a phenomenally low fraction, right? Most people who engage in any kind of hurtful or abusive behavior never get touched by any system at all. And our programs are not the answer to this as a social dynamic. We are an answer. We're part of a big system, but it's a big social problem. We're here as a resource. But
what's the prognosis?
It depends on where you take your starting point, right? So if you start with, people that are that act abusively that never get touched by the system, how do I know? If you start with people who have had a consequence of one form or another, but it's only a very tiny consequence and they've never been asked to follow through on anything significant. All the way up to, like, if I would go through various stages of intervention to the place of, like, a program like ours. So somebody that walks through the door is already in many ways selected because they've been pushed. They have had the willingness to allow themselves to get pushed, even if resentfully. And so then we take about 2/3 of the people that walk through our door and put them in one of our groups. Somewhere around 1/3 complete a whole 33-week program, and those are the ones we've studied mostly. They have pretty good results. Although, if you want more rigorous stuff, there's something in the Wall Street Journal just from last week of a really nice, probably the premier study in the country by Ed Gondolf. It was a CDC Center for Disease Control study. And he did like 30 and 48 month follow-ups, 618 men. And he found that there was actually a pretty significant impact. Two-thirds of the women said their quality of life had improved. 85% said they felt very safe.
Wow. Wow.
Here was the key point, that the men who completed the program were much less likely. But that is a big issue.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Completion
is
the big issue. Is the big thing.
Sure.
Whether they're willing to allow themselves to be in it long enough to get the benefit.
So we talked about treatment for men. Let's turn to you. And what are the resources available for women, women who have been abused or being abused, and women who abuse?
Well, Menergy works with women who abuse as well as men who abuse in both heterosexual and same-sex relationships.
Okay.
And women who are victims or survivors are serviced by the four domestic violence organizations that were just mentioned, as well as Women Organized Against Rape. And there's shelter, legal advocacy, crisis counseling, safety planning. Sometimes people just make a call to the hotline. I want to reiterate that we believe the numbers are way higher than we would ever imagine, because many people... This is a silent epidemic, and many people don't call the hotline or show up in an emergency room or go to family court for a protection from abuse order.
And the beauty of what's happening now is it's not quite so silent as it used to be. Listen, we're talking about domestic abuse, domestic violence. Please give us a call if you know, you've had experience with this, if you were in the middle of it, one way or the other, if you are have a history of impulse control and you feel some guilt, shame, regret about something you've done or are doing, please give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. On the other hand, you know, if you've been on the other side of the coin, please, please call us. 888-477-9499. To those several of you who are on the line, I want to ask you to please call back. We had a glitch in our phone system, so please, please call back, because I see summaries of the issues you're calling about, and I really would love to get you on the air. 888-477-9499. We're talking with social workers Tony Lapp and Marcy Witherspoon about this difficult and hopeful subject. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
I'm Robin Young. Why do Muslim women veil? Many reasons, but a scholar says mostly because they want to.
Islamic fashion is part of how Muslim women express their modernity. And by showing that they can be actively engaged in the world while being observant.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about domestic violence, domestic abuse, with Marcy Witherspoon, who's former director of children and youth at the Institute for Safe Families. She is part or was part of the Philadelphia ACEs task force. Is part.
Is part.
Okay, that's still ongoing. And Tony Lapp is the co-director of Menergy, which is a program with a national reputation, been around for many, many years, and they're just doing wonderful work. All these resources are going to be on our webpage. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tony, you talked about PTSD earlier, and of course that plays a role in many incidents of of violence. I want to talk about the PTSD that violence creates, mm-hmm. and especially to those who bear witness, to children who are watching parents or caretakers harm one another, and what that does to them. And apropos of the ACEs task force, adverse childhood experience, what does that do to them, and does that put them at more risk for becoming violent?
The ACE study, which and the Philadelphia ACE task force is kind of a follow-up to the premier study, public health study, which was published in 1998, which looks at levels of abuse and household dysfunctions that occur in childhood and that impact children. And domestic violence, exposure to domestic violence by children, is one of those ACEs that have been studied, one of those adverse childhood experiences that has been studied. And it's actually been linked to both physical and mental health outcomes decades later in life, really linking them to the top 10 reasons why people die, and as well as increases problems with aggression, with anxiety and depression, increases the risk for asthma, obesity, suicidal ideation.
Cancer, long bone breaks, I read.
In terms of the outcomes later in life, it's incredible. COPD, liver cancer, heart disease.
Life-altering learning disability. They're six times more likely.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when you are exposed to domestic violence, there's also something else that's going on. Actually, exposure to domestic violence is linked to more increases in mental health disorders than being a direct victim of violence by a mm-hmm. child himself or herself. So it's huge, and the Philadelphia ACE Task Force is really looking at how do we integrate information about ACEs into the work that we do as clinicians to try to do more prevention.
Tell us about prevention. What can we do to help prevent? What can we do for children, for parents?
Well, I think early on, we need to start teaching children healthy ways to resolve conflict and to problem solve. And I'm not talking at middle school age. I'm talking at very, very young ages when they're 3 and 4, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, learning to share, learning to resolve without resorting to hitting, so that children are modeled appropriate conflict resolution and they learn even before they have language, that they are modeled healthy ways to resolve conflict, so that when they are beginning to have relationships, that they understand the concepts of respect and responsibility in a relationship. And early on, when Tony first answered, when he was talking about real men and quoting President Obama, real men don't hit women, I mean, in any kind of relationship, we shouldn't be hitting one another.
Right.
I mean, whatever kind of relationship, that's not an indication of a healthy relationship. And so we need to teach young people the tools of, relationship, healthy relationships, responsible relationships, respect, and the concept of, like, you have to give respect to earn respect.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones here. We've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan. Susan?
Yes, I'm here.
Sure, good. What can we do for you?
Well, I was married to an abuser for 15 years. Mm-hmm. He was, as you talked about previously, he was one of those impulsive abusers. He drank, and he would come home and beat me. And I finally had the courage to leave him, and he killed himself when my son was about 13. And then I met a man who seemed to be the exact opposite. He was a lawyer, and he seemed to embody everything that was good. But it turned out that he had really just methodically picked me out so that he could wield his power over me in other ways. And he psychologically abused me the entire time that we were together. He moved into my home. He was stealing money and infrequently would physically abuse me. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm starting to come to terms with why I would have ignored all the warning signs, but he is still re-victimizing me. I was able to get him out of my home last year when he hit me in the head with an air conditioner and I got a concussion. So I have a 3-year protection from abuse order from him. And I've hooked up with the Women's Center of Montgomery County, great, who have been enormously helpful. Great. And they are a great resource, mm-hmm, for people like me.
What? But,
yes.
What do you want, need of us?
If I could just know how to stay strong. I mean, just some hints about how to stay strong. I think maybe just to spread the word that it's not just people. I mean, people. He was like, he's a sociopath. So you've got this person who abuses you psychologically as well as physically and has no remorse.
Susan, what do you mean by stay strong?
I'm sorry, what?
What do you mean by stay strong?
Not walk around being afraid all the time, not be hypervigilant, not have PTSD, and, you know, when you hear a loud sound, you just, and this has been, I mean, the PTSD has just come on so strong since last year.
Listen. Let me hold your hand here, okay?
Okay.
All right. You can't talk yourself out of PTSD or hypervigilance. You can't turn your back on your history. Some fear is adaptive. There's a reason why we're afraid. Sometimes it carries valuable information. Sometimes we do need to look over our shoulder. It's how we preserve our own lives. So you're looking for security. So you're not going to talk yourself out of it. And,
okay.
And I'm not done holding your hand yet. I also want to say this, that feeling vulnerable and feeling scared is not about weakness, Susan. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my God, if feeling vulnerable and feeling scared was a sign of weakness, I would be a bowl of Jell-O right now. You can, you know what real strength is, Susan?
What?
Is being able to tolerate your own weakness, your own fear, and your own vulnerability. That's what real strength is. It's not by making yourself different. It's not by turning your back on your vulnerability. It's by standing up and taking the next step forward as a vulnerable woman, as somebody who's scared, and as somebody who needs help. You know, we
yes.
all need to have our hands held. And
yeah, I just feel like people are so tired of this.
Well, wait.
I mean, the people in my life, really, it's like enough already.
Well, you'll have to ask them that question. Ask them if they're tired. Don't try to read people's minds, because with all due respect, you probably suck at it. Nothing personal. Marcy, I'd like to hear you chime in. Don't go anywhere, Susan.
Okay.
Well, I just want to echo that, right? PTSD, just because a relationship ends, or even when you're safe, some of the trauma continues to play on in your mind. And
yes.
and you even will have trauma triggers. So if you do hear a loud noise, if you do see something, smell something, hear something that makes you remember, you can almost relive that situation. So there's nothing at all wrong with you. What's so wonderful that you're doing is acknowledging it. I mean, that is clearly the first and going for help, because you said you're going to the women's center in Montgomery.
And I have a wonderful psychologist.
Good,
that's who has just been wonderful. But it's
hard, and it takes
a
while,
because he's a lawyer. And now he's trying to take me to court to get a piece of my house, my very own house that I bought and paid for with my own money.
Right.
While he was, you know, not contributing anything, and we were never married.
Tony?
So it's just this constant, like, you know, and he knows he will probably lose, but he wants me to be really scared.
Right. Susan, I would want to say this to you, that if there'd be anything I would wish for you, it would be that you would have so much support. Because what you're describing, this would be hard for anybody. The most together person in the world would be so rocked by what you're describing. I'm so happy of the kinds of support that it sounds like you have, and I wish for you more. I wish for you legal advocacy. I wish for you all kinds of things, because this is a lot. You know, in our program, we think of success in sort of two ways. One is when we can appeal to the person and they respond. That's the gold standard. That's what we're shooting with for every abusive person that walks through our door. But we know it won't work with everyone. Some people it works very nicely with, and they really want to be better people, and some people don't. So the other thing, and we've been learning this from some interesting research, that programs like ours get used for is for abused partners to gather information for their own decision-making processes. So, you know, if you're either one of these two very difficult partners had come to us, the thing I would have hoped that you would have come away from, you, I'm saying, not them, you, would have come away from in terms of interaction with the program, if they had not responded well to the model, is that you would have come away with a greater sense of peace, that you had done what you could do.
I also want to add one other thing, Susan.
Yes.
And that is, when I said I wanted to hold your hand, I meant that literally, and there is something about your vulnerability, anybody's vulnerability, that opens people's hearts. It is a physiologic reaction, and I wanted to hold your hand. Susan, I wanted to hold you. So
it
is your great skill at opening up and talking about what's scary and where it's scary and how it's scary that mobilized people. I mean, my God, it certainly mobilized me. So I wish you the best. And listen, when you are alone, the best thing you can do is be kind and compassionate to this good woman who suffers.
I will do that. I will do my best to do that.
Please, please.
All thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your kindness.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Susan. Thank you for your courage in calling this show.
Okay.
So you guys are going to have to take over, because I'm going to need 20 minutes to recover from that call. I am. That's a half a joke. I am. Oof, yeah. I'm so deeply moved.
Right. Yes, this is draining work. And the other thing that I would want to say to Susan is that what we know is that the way people heal and move forward is when we have safe, supportive, and nurturing relationships. And being kind to herself and compassionate to herself and surrounding herself with the support of people who don't say, come on, get over it. Haven't you bellyached about this enough?
Is it
blaming the victim type of response?
I tell people when I suffer, I want, and I find myself in a dark hole, I want to be with people who love me enough to sit there with me.
Yes.
I don't need cheerleaders on the outside telling me how to get out.
Right.
It's hard to do.
You have to sit in the boat and paddle sometimes with the person.
Yeah.
As opposed to rescuing the boat.
It's hard to do. There's a couple of other issues here that I want to cover, and I want to talk about what we do for the children and what can be done for the children. We're learning more and more about effective treatment for trauma and PTSD, but what are the resources that are out there available? I know psychiatrist Dr. Stephen Berkowitz at University of Pennsylvania is doing a lot of good work. So tell us what's out there, Marcy.
Yes, there are also two additional organizations that provide trauma-focused therapy for children who've been exposed to domestic violence. One is the Children's Crisis Treatment Center, their trauma assistance program, and the other is the Anti-Violence Partnership of Philadelphia. But any organization that offers trauma-focused work, because we want to make sure that people aren't, and here's we're back to labels, but people aren't just labeling behavior and not getting at the etiology of the behavior, and that people aren't just seeing PTSD behavior and saying, oh, it's ADD or ADHD, and prescribing medication, which is not getting at the root of the problem. So there are ways, but children have to start being given permission to develop a trauma narrative and tell their story so that they can heal and move forward and not repeat the patterns of their childhood.
Quickly?
Yeah, I wanted to say something about just men, because, you know, I'm a man and I work with a lot of men and I have a son. And I think that we oftentimes just forget that there's little ways that we can be working with the children in our own lives around not setting up very strict models about what it means to have to be a real boy or a real girl or a real man or a real woman. And if there's any little ways in people's personal lives that they can do that, I actually think that that can go a long way.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. And I want to thank you both so much for coming out here and having this conversation. My apologies to all the callers I didn't get to, but I thought it would be helpful to spend more time with Susan, who really illustrated the heart and soul of what these issues are. We've been talking about domestic violence with Tony Lapp and Marcy Witherspoon. Next week, we're going to be talking about Curiosity, a new book that's out about curiosity and how its presence or absence changes the quality of our lives. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. At Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. You can hear about my upcoming lectures there. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Thanks to all of you. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.
You're listening to